Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that each week this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And we will introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I would really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know that can benefit from today's show. This is one powerful way that we, together, can make a positive difference in the world. Now, unfortunately, with all the negativity and divisiveness out there these days, we need to have other ways, other places to go to get good information. And I hope that you will find answersforthefamily.com, a place you can go to hear some of the good and positive things that are happening all over the world. Now, with this in mind, if there was ever a time in recent years that we needed to focus on gratitude, this is the time. Well, my son Chase and I wrote The Attitude of Gratitude Journal, something that at the time was geared towards teens going through some changes in their life. Well, right now we're all going through changes in our lives. So please go to our website at answersforthefamily.com and download a free copy. It is our gift to you. All I ask is that you subscribe, which is for free, and focusing on gratitude has meant to you and your family. Now, a quote, although not from the journal, is by Johnny Depp. And this one is, I am doing things that are true to me. The only thing I have a problem with is being labeled. So I think that's something that fits right in with our client, with our guest, because that's a lot of what she is really, I felt in going through the book, talking about is let's look at doing things that are true to ourselves and not get wrapped up in a lot of the labeling that goes on. So our topic today is redefining our attitudes of love and sex. Our guest, Dr. Kelly Neff, is a social psychologist, professor, futurist, author, and talk show personality who has electrified the transformational media world with her unique focus on the intersection of psychology, consciousness, and human sexuality. Now, a research psychologist and millennial disruptor with a commitment to exploring the leading edge of psychology and technology, she wrote her first book, Teaching Psychology Online, in 2013. Her new book, Sex Positive, epitomizes her desire to empower sexual freedom, inspire healing, and improve people's relationships by fusing cutting-edge scientific findings with Eastern philosophies and her own deeply personal insights. Kelly, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much for having me. And I couldn't agree more about the attitude of gratitude.
Well, thank you. And that is something we've really tried to focus on with this show. You know, there's so much science out there that really talks about, you know, how negativity goes into our brain and in some cases is somewhere between 7 and 10 times more powerful at staying with us. So I feel that people like yourself and I, we have to work that much harder to provide enough positive things for people to think about and focus on so that we can offset some of the other stuff that's being planted out there.
And there's so much of it, especially lately. You know, when I wrote Sex Positive, it came out in February 2020. And who could have known how much more important those types of messages would become and how much we would really be tested you know, since then.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that as I was reading about you and some of the things that you're doing, and one of the things was these, I don't know the best way to put them, but musical group hug things. And I read about it and I thought, that is so great. And then I went, but I'm sure we're not doing that right now.
We're unfortunately cuddle puddle parties.
Puddles. That's right.
Human physical contact is so important to us, and it is essential to our well-being on a number of different levels, not only physically, but also obviously emotionally and spiritually. And that's definitely been one of the hardest things for me, and I think for a lot of people right now, is that we don't have that ability to physically connect. And not only that, but physical connection has become something that's fearful and dirty or grotesque.
It's interesting to bring that up, because right now there's a lot of battling back and forth between whose science is right and whose science is wrong. And the big argument usually for whoever it is that's putting down the science that they disagree with is saying, well, you haven't had enough trials. You haven't had enough tests. Well, when did they do tests on the fact that by having people not have any sort of social and physical commitment and touch, when did they do any tests as to how that's going to affect us long term? They're not talking about that.
So, I couldn't agree more. And we know from social psychology, skin hunger is a real thing. Skin hunger, you're some people, literally, they are physical touch people, and they get this thirst. That's why these, and not in an unhealthy drive state way, but in a very natural human experience way, that they need that touch and nurturing and the way that it makes their brain feel. That's why these cuddle puddle parties were so successful, because it's not sexual. Yeah. It's about touch. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, I know we said we talk about this a little later, but, you know, look at the world that we're in right now. We don't know the mental health consequences of what this isolation and downturn is going to do. But what we do know is that suicide and substance use and misuse and mental health problems are through the roof, potentially even killing more people than COVID and its complications right now. Yeah. And there isn't a dialogue about this. And I feel that it's incredibly important that we talk about mental health, that we are able to express the ways in which the isolation is affecting us. So we're not alone, and we need to be heard about this topic right now.
I couldn't agree more. And so getting back to the book a little bit, I've already had a few people that have asked me the question. They said, sex positive, what does that mean? Is that mean, you know, somebody said sex positive, does that mean we need to be having more? Does that mean we need to be in a better positive outlook? And I said, listen to the show. I'll ask the question. So let me ask you. So it, to you, what does it mean when you say sex positive?
It's such a great question. It's not about having more sex or having lots of sex. It's about having a healthy sexual relationship with yourself and any of the partners in your life. So this is not about just being sex crazed, and people often use, oh, you're sex positive, well, you should have sex with me. And it becomes coercive, which again is the opposite. Sex positive is about honesty, trust, consent. And it's what we need in the world right now, recovering from and still going through the Me Too movement and all of this other stuff, that's the Catholic Church and pedophilia and all this horrible sexual stuff that has come out that's very traumatic and triggering. And this is a way of creating a new dialogue about what is right. And it's not about morality or, say, religious teachings about what is right or wrong. It's about your own individual morality for yourself and what feels right for you. As long as everything is consenting and there's no coercion, you should be able to have sex as much as you want or as little as you want without being shamed or judged by our culture and by our society.
And well, you just brought up the Me Too movement. So how has the Me Too movement pushed sexual positivity further into the limelight in a positive way?
It really has. It's created a space. Now, obviously, it's been very difficult and upsetting for many of us. So many people are survivors of sexual assault. That we don't even really have accurate statistics because so many assaults go unreported. But this is something that in the workshops I do and the events I do, in the classes I used to teach as a professor of human sexuality, the majority of all of the people have been sexually assaulted in some way or had attempted sexual assaults or close to someone who's been assaulted. So this is very real for us. And it's something that's been wrapped up in shame and guilt and fear. So coming out of that and having a unified voice right now is something that I think is extremely important. We need that community, even if it's an online community. And what it's done is it's mobilized people to say, we're not going to stand for this anymore. This is not okay. And we're going to put this out there that there's no such thing as like consensual sex. All sex should be consensual. Otherwise it's rape. Yeah. And this is something that we're not like, we need to change the dialogue. And you look at our conditioning as a society, the last say 2000 years and all through our literature, all through there's always been kind of this undercurrent of people not respecting consent. And that's what's changing right now. So even these Disney movies that I grew up with in the 80s, think about it like this. Mm-hmm. You have a princess who's asleep and strange men kissing her while she's asleep. That is not consent.
Yeah.
And that's what we're teaching our children. So it's ingrained in us almost to not respect that. So what's happened now with the Me Too movement is I think it's a really positive thing. And it's a lot of people, but that you can be sex positive, but that means respecting yourself and respecting other people and their choices and their physical autonomy.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. And you just touched on the concept of shame. And one of the questions that came in, and again, I want to take this time to thank those that take the time to send in questions. We really appreciate it. We do everything we can to make sure that we get to those. And this one touches on that subject. This one reads, my mother was very active in the, quote, free love movement of the 60s. She avoids the topic with us as if there is some shame attached to it. I have been fascinated by that period for many reasons, and I'm very curious about what similarities might exist then and now. I purchased your book for my mother and got one for me as well. I'm really looking forward to her opinions and some lively conversation about the subject. And this is from Benjamin in Arizona.
Oh, thank you, Benjamin in Arizona. I appreciate that. I think there are a lot of similarities. And it's interesting because the movement in the 60s, you know, there wasn't the same amount of risk and pressure associated with sexuality, right? It was before the HIV/AIDS crisis. It was a different time. Nowadays, there is absolutely still kind of like a free love movement, but I think that's only part of it because part of now, sex positivity now is that we have to be able to be more responsible and more active. So getting consent, this is something that, and not to go back to consent again, but it's so important. You know, when you're, let's say you're at a music festival, and I've done a lot of workshops about polyamory and open relationships at festivals. And of course, you know, people are intoxicated, they're experimenting. And then what happens after the fact, right? What happens after what moment? People who are on drugs or drinking can't give consent. And I know that psychedelics are kind of a part of the free love movement or part of the way we consider the free love movement. But I think that what we're seeing now is that there are more people experimenting with open relationships. And I think that's probably what Benjamin is talking about a little bit. So when I say open relationships, polyamory is one type of an open relationship. So the difference is here that if you're in an open relationship, your other partner or partners know that you're also with other people and you can talk about it. Now, the extent to which you want to dive in and talk about it varies from person to person, but it's not cheating. So you're not in an open relationship. You're not polyamorous if you're just going behind your partner's back. That's just cheating. And obviously, you know, we've seen the complete deterioration of the institution of marriage, just the huge amounts of cheating, huge amounts of divorce. And it has caused a lot of scientists, myself included, to think that perhaps what if monogamy is a choice and it's not necessarily the natural right way of doing things? And I have a long discussion in the book about this. And I strongly recommend the book Sex at Dawn as well. It really goes into kind of the study of human prehistory and how we've been in open, non-monogamous groups, egalitarian groups to survive for our entire evolution as humans in 1,000 years. So If that's possible, then it's also possible some people might be inherently non-monogamous. So what we're seeing now is about 1 in 5 sexually active adults in America has experimented with non-monogamy. That's quite a lot. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, it's 20%. And I feel that the free love movement might have brought this into our consciousness, but this also might be something that has been maybe even in our evolutionary history for some of us. And I want to make it very clear, as part of being sex positive, that whether you're monogamous or non-monogamous, one's not better. It's not like, oh, because I am non-monogamous and I've been in a non-monogamous relationship for almost a decade. However, I don't think I'm better. I don't think it's more spiritual. That's another thing that we see a lot of, mm-hmm. kind of, well, I'm more spiritual because I practice non-attachment. So, and if you're monogamous and you're happily monogamous, that's also great. It's not a competition. It's not a judgment that one is necessarily better than the other. And I think it's really important to stop making these equivalencies when we're talking about sexuality and kind of allow people to make their choices and respect those choices.
Well, and I also think it's important, if those are just now tuning in, if you missed the first part of what she was saying, is this is when both people agree to be monogamous. Mm. You can't have one that agrees and one that doesn't.
Oh, you can. You can.
Well,
there are definitely situations where you can have a partner who's polyamorous or non-monogamous with a partner who's monogamous, and they agree, I'm going to be monogamous to you, and you are going to be with other people, and that's how it works. This actually is more common than you might think. So it can work as long as there's honesty in communication. Honesty.
But that was the point that I was making, is that you pointed out that, you know, if you are not being honest with that other person.
It's just cheating.
Yeah.
And I'm really against cheating. I'm really against lying. I hate lying in relationships because we need conflict. That's what we don't realize. Conflict is actually constructive in relationships because it's how we come to solutions. It's how we actually grow together. So if you're just lying and hiding and avoiding, it's not really going to get you where you want. If you want to be in a satisfying, happy, real relationship, which is why, people always ask me, I used to do these workshops a lot about, how do I tell my partner I might want to experiment with someone else? How do I tell them? I think I might be non-monogamous. I'm afraid to say anything. And as with all sexual explorations, kinks, whatever, if you're not willing to share, how do you know they're going to reject you? You're assuming that your voice doesn't matter. You're assuming they don't want to hear you. But you have to give your partner the chance to accept you. If you really want to be in this relationship, there is no room for that fear and that self-judgment. And that's where a lot of this comes from, is judgment of self, feeling like no one could actually see you or accept you for who you are if you were honest. And I'm really here to tell people, you deserve your truth. You deserve your voice, and your voice matters. And the people who care about you and the right people will respect that voice.
Well, you touch on another thing that I think also adds to the changes that have occurred, and that is the fact that we are now in the digital age. So how has the digital age changed the way in which people approach sex and their relationships?
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's really changed everything. You know, one of the things that we laugh about in sexology is, look, people have always been, you know, cheaters or shady, but certainly they never had a tool like the internet before where they could just, you know, it's human nature, you know, to want to explore options. But what's happened with the digital age and online dating is it's become quite toxic for a lot of us, because with all of these options, it's very difficult to want to commit and look at what's in front of you. And a lot of people out there online dating are looking for commitment, but a lot of them are just looking for their ego boost and self-esteem boost. And the last chapter of my book is all about kind of online dating and the pitfalls of online dating. And one thing that we're seeing is, I think it was 13% of college students who were on Tinder were doing it for ego boost and entertainment. So you have like people who really want to find love mixed in with people who are literally just doing it out of boredom. And now, oh my gosh, in the last 6 months, right, you add in COVID reality to that.
Yes.
And, you know, it's, I've heard nothing but worse and worse stories lately about online dating and kind of what it's doing for people right now, that it's just everyone's demanding, everyone's toxic. But again, there also are love stories, and you know, it's not one size fits all.
But while we're on that subject, because I know you do touch on it in the book, let's talk about how that affects people's self-esteem. And I know that I was talking with somebody who was explaining to their father, and their father was, I think, in his 70s, and they were explaining to him what Tinder was. And it, you know, and sort of going, well, see, you do this and you swipe this and you do all of this. And they said he paused and he said, how terrible for these people. And he saw it just so negatively because he said, there's so much rejection. He says, I just see how difficult this must be on people from the rejection side. So let's talk about how that affects people's self-esteem.
It's, you know, it's amazing that we actually have data to prove it and back it up. And one of the most tragic things is it actually is affecting men's self-esteem worse than women's self-esteem. University of Michigan did a survey and they found that people who used online dating, not only did they have lower self-esteem than people who didn't online date, but they also had higher levels of body shaming and higher levels of internalizing society's gender norms. Right. And when they looked at the data more, they found that men were disproportionately more likely to feel depressed and insecure and have self-esteem issues than women. And they think it's because of the rejection. So, and the way that men operate too. So, you know, throw crap at a wall, see what sticks, so to say. But in online dating terms, there are more men than women on all the main dating sites at a ratio of about 2-1. So already there's more competition there. Second of all, instead of, you know, going to a bar and chatting with a couple girls an hour, you can get rejected by like 100 girls in an hour if you play your cards right. And so that rejection compounds itself. And studies have even shown that rejection, social rejection, causes the same effect in the brain as physical pain. Mm-hmm. So that broken heart, it feels like a broken bone. And over time, that can really wear you down. And so I always tell people, especially the men that I work with, that it's important to take a break. Of course, now, how else are you going to meet people? This is the problem. It's almost like we're stuck with this because I can't go to a bar. If you go to a bar here where I live, you have to sit with your table only, and you're not allowed to talk to anybody else outside. You're literally not allowed to meet people right now.
Stay 6 feet away from everybody.
Yeah. So then people go back to the online dating because they don't know what else to do. I also think there's another really important component to this that needs to be mentioned, which is digital sex. So as opposed to online dating, you know, sex toys, pornography use, and my favorite topic, which is the impending rise of the sex robots. And people thought I was crazy when I was writing about this. And then you look now at the world, well, okay, we're afraid of potentially, we're becoming germophobic. And mm-hmm. many of us already were germophobic, but not wanting to engage with a human being out of fear, some kind of a sex aid, where it's a sex doll or sex robot, it does seem more and more like this is going to be the natural transition.
And not only that, but I mean, and you mentioned in your book the possibility of, I mean, it's even getting married to intelligent sex. Yeah. So
there's a lot of data out there to support that this is the direction we're going in. And people think it's like, I'm making it up, like it's this dirty, creepy sci-fi, but we're also not realizing that generationally we have different levels of tolerances for technology as well. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get a cell phone until I was after high school. I'm not that into, you know, technology. But if I grew up with a cell phone, a lot of these kids now in Gen Z, I mean, they're not suffering as much as, say, my generation or your generation is with the isolation, because their preferred way of connection is through Snapchat and TikTok and apps and texting, right?
That's a great
So it's not that shocking to them. So they're like, all right, they already have this high tolerance for technology. So this is why we're trending down in sex. And it's one of the most fascinating things. Did you know that my generation, the millennials, is having less sex per year than the boomers did at my age, for example. We're having less sex because we have more options. We don't need another person to get off. We have all these great sex toys, all this great porn, you know, et cetera. And we're just less reliant on other people to gratify ourselves.
Right. But so if I understand it correctly, and I think this is how you have it in the book also. So they're having less sex than adults 30 years ago did, but they're having more orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? Yes.
Exactly. Yes, indeed. I know. Yes, they are. Way more orgasms. And again, a lot of that sexual shame, part of sex positivity is saying it's okay to pleasure yourself. It's okay to demystify the female orgasm. You know, women and men get off very differently, and that's okay. For so long, the female orgasm was viewed as kind of like male orgasm light, as in if a guy gets off from vaginal intercourse, then therefore, a woman must get off from vaginal intercourse too. And that's the primary way, when we know that 9 out of 10 women prefer clitoral stimulation. But if you're one of those women who prefers vaginal orgasm, good for you too, right? But we're kind of like, we're breaking through these layers of all this shame that's been on us for so long. And a lot of it comes from religion. It comes from our society. It comes from the media. It comes from our own parents too, and our conditioning. It comes from our understanding of like rigid gender roles and gender norms. We're having more orgasms, but we're having less sex with humans. So, and I feel like this pandemic is just going to push it even further, accelerate that trend to keep us away from each other. Yeah.
So now, as we're making this shift, how do you think that this is going to affect the meaning of love, because there's so many people associate them together. Is there going to be a divide? How can we actually make love stronger? What do you think?
I wish I knew. I think it could go either way, and it really depends on the individual and kind of where they're coming from and their intention and what they're putting in energetically into the relationship. I do have some fear, though, that the more isolated we become, the more dehumanizing and detached our understandings become. And the more, I don't want to say selfish or narcissistic, but the more self-absorbed we become, because our needs start to matter more because we're disconnected from everybody else. Like if I live in social isolation for the rest of my life, I'm not going to have that same level of empathy and compassion that I would. You start to believe, and we're already seeing it, you know, with politics and Facebook, right? Where people's own feedback loop, they only seek out information that supports how they already feel. And when something challenges it, they're very angry and they don't want to engage. So I could see this also being applied to our love relationships too, especially if we are falling in love with robots, because let's face it. I mean, it's who doesn't want to fall in love with a being created solely for their own pleasure that they can turn on or off with a button? it's potentially problematic for our abilities to express empathy and seeing the toxicness, seeing how people use each other and ghost each other, seeing how mean people are to complete strangers on the internet because they're fearful themselves and they want to lash out. Seeing all of these trends, like, I do think it's problematic for where love is going. And that's why, like you said, cultivating gratitude, you know, it's very important to cultivate love and gratitude and empathy and realize you are not the only person in the world that matters, right?
Well, that's what we're doing. We're trying to cultivate love. We're trying to cultivate gratitude. And we are going to take a break. We are going to be right back. We're talking about the book, and the book is called Sex Positive. And we are talking with Dr. Neff, who has written a book that really opens some people's eyes. So if you are sitting behind a desk and you're not in your car, and if you want to go ahead and bring that up, just quickly Google Sex Positive, and you will bring up Dr. Kelly Neff, and you will see what it is that we're talking about.
Yep.
But stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis. Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We are with Dr. Kelly Neff. We are talking about her book, Sex Positive. Can you hold that book up again? I think you had it up. But in fact, just as we were going, I was trying to look to where the subcategory was. and it threw me off for a moment. But again, it is something that, you know, a lot of people would think, oh, okay, well, this is something new. Everything is new about this. You know, it's somebody's coming out with a new way to think. One of the things that I noticed when I was researching you was you actually studied ancient wisdom as as it would relate to this. So when people are thinking that, oh, this is all brand new, no, actually, there was a lot of ancient wisdom and traditions that went in. So share a little bit about some of the ancient sexual wisdom traditions and things that you learned as to how living positive affects us today.
I think one of the most amazing things is that time is very circular in its own way. And we often go through these patterns almost in our collective consciousness or collective unconscious that we are working through. So a lot of these ideas about sex as energy medicine and sexuality as healing, for example, like the benefits of orgasm, right? And all kinds of dopamine, immune system, the whole thing. Well, we've known this. And a lot of these ancient wisdom traditions have been around for thousands of years that have used sex as a tool. Part of my own journey has been learning about that and kind of opening myself up to that. And I mean, I even have my chakras here on my arm, which is the human energy body, as a reminder to like meditate and as a reminder that this is real or it has felt real for me, because a lot of people are like, I don't believe in that. And that's fine. but they're the ancient wisdom traditions. I'm thinking like Taoism and Tantra, and the white tigresses is my favorite of all of these histories. And again, it's anecdotal, but it's this idea. So Taoism has been about using the balance of masculine and feminine. And I don't mean gender wise, I mean energetically. We all have masculine and feminine yin and yang elements in our body. And it's about creating a union with them, both within your body and within yourself and your partner or partners. And they've taken it one step further. Now, for Taoism, it was more focused on the male practices. So ejaculatory frequency, for example, that they believed that his men's energy and potency was actually in his ejaculate. And he had to restrain that ejaculate by letting it out all the time. It actually decreased his virility. And then you have on the other side, you have the women that are trying to extract it for their own life-saving benefits and virility. And it's a fascinating kind of interplay. So you have this, and I strongly recommend, it's an entertaining book, The Secrets of the White Tigresses by C. Lee, which is a pseudonym, the secret sect in Taiwan that's been very closed off for decades, never let anyone in, and they let this Western journalist in and train with, and it features all of their practices for training. And basically for them, sex was medicine, and you can literally use sexual chi, which is the life force, to make yourself younger, make yourself healthier. And the best part is the ultimate goal here is immortality, which I just love. So a lot of this has been around. And then you have the Kudoshka on the Native American side, which was again, all about the wheels or the chulas or the chakras, basically. So this is something that's been around, and maybe part of our awakening that's happening now is that we are starting to reconnect to the old wisdom that we had lost. And if you look at the rise of esoteric traditions, and you're in LA, you know, yeah. I mean, you look at the rise of yoga and all of the health practices, it's because in part, you know, we're suffering in a very sick world that makes us feel very small and very afraid sometimes. And these practices are expansive. They bring this peace and this wellness to us. And it's something that we need right now, now more than ever.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
I couldn't agree more. So you were talking about some of the things that you believe. You believe in the existence of soulmates.
You know, I do. I think it's an interesting question because it, again, it's one of those personal things, but I do. I think that, and I don't mean in the sense of like the Disney, I'm going to go back. I'm just ragging on Disney today. but in the sense of, you know, like you have your one person who is like, you know, I don't believe in necessarily one person, but I do believe you have like a family of soulmates that you reincarnate with over and over, that you can learn from with each other.
Would this be like your tribe?
Kind of, yeah, like your soul family. And I believe personally, and I know it's hard as a scientist, you know, because I really do believe in science, but I also believe that there are a lot of phenomena that we don't have the tools to understand and explain with science yet. So it's easy to say they're not real. But you know, what is real? Eventually, maybe we'll have technology that can measure the frequency of the chakras spinning. You know, well, as far as reincarnation, I think that that's going to be a tough one to measure, but certainly. So I think that we have our twin flame. That's really what I believe in, is like the traditional soulmate that, and I love Anaya Sophia's description of this in this sacred sexual consciousness that she writes about, where you, at the time of the creation of your soul, you were split and you are always trying to get back to this person. And you have this karmic strong connection that just being around them, it evokes tons of growth and evolution in you. And then you have your soul family or your soul mates that are also a part of that, but they're not the same as that twin flame. And do I believe I found my twin flame? Yeah, I do. Do I believe that it's been really difficult? Yeah. And I think that's kind of the part, is that everything good requires a lot of work in relationships. And we all talk about like wanting relationships to be easy and wanting relationships to just flow. But the good relationships take work. Everything is tough. You know, like you're growing with someone, you're vulnerable, you're learning to communicate. All of these things take time. And again, going back to what we were saying about love, real love to me is in that difficulty. Not saying you should have to suffer, but that you should be willing to work. And even for your twin flames and soulmates, those people will push you the hardest. They're like the reflection of the mirror of everything that you're doing. They reflect it right back to you. And you can just tell when you meet that person. I don't know if you've ever met a person like that. But yeah, you can just tell. You're like, oh, this person just sees right through me, but I love it.
Well, we have another question that has come in from a listener, and this one reads, many of us who are teachers are greatly concerned about the sexual activity occurring with our youth. I teach 14-year-olds. I agree we need a fresh new approach as it applies to gender, respect, and equality, but early sexual experiences may be negating and doing emotional harm. So what happens in later relationships when they have not had safe and meaningful experiences, and instead sex is treated as a notch on one's belt or a result of peer pressure? Does your book address these issues? And that's from Mary in New York.
Mary in New York. Excellent question. I think that one of the hardest parts about being sex positive is that sex is not always a positive experience, right? Especially at young ages. And I wrote this book in hopes that it would help create a dialogue between teachers and their students, and between parents and their children, and between siblings, that we could say, it's okay to say no. And it's okay. I think one of the biggest issues is, you know, pornography. And not that I don't have a problem with adults watching pornography, but children watching pornography and thinking that that's the way that it should go down, thinking it's real. Because it's teaching them, this is entertainment, that, you know, it's teaching them that they should try to model this behavior. And that's, I think, where a lot of the pain is coming from, is that they're not being taught, instead of telling them not to watch it or trying to censor it, I think it's also important to explain everything that we consume as media is exploitation and entertainment. It's not real. And we need to be more proactive about having that media literacy conversation with young people, because Mary is absolutely right. You have these traumatic and many traumatic experiences and assault and triggering experiences and issues with consent happen when people are young, either with their peers or, you know, with older adults taking advantage of them. And like, we need to have better dialogue in place for this. We need to be able to bring people together so they can understand, A, if it's happened, how they can get through it and how they can cope. And B, if it hasn't happened, how to set up boundaries. And a huge part of being sex positive is learning to set boundaries. And it is never too early to start teaching kids about that. If you look at Europe, you look at their school system out there, they're teaching five-year-olds about gender, about sexual orientation, about their body autonomy. We're not doing that. Maybe we're starting to, but you know, for a very long time, we've had an abstinence-only federally funded education program, which means that literally if you are getting federal funds as a public school, you can only teach about abstinence. Don't have sex. Sex is bad. This is not the education we need. We need to talk about safe sex. We need to talk about consent. We need to talk about the body. So I definitely have a lot of those ideas in the book. And I would love to hear from people like Mary who are going to be able to kind of use them to communicate with their students.
Well, and you just mentioned in regards to sexual trauma, and for those that are new to the show or that don't know my background, as a detective, one of the things we do is we return runaways, and many of which have been exploited.
This could not be more relevant right now.
Well, exactly. And that's the other thing, with everybody's worried about COVID and stuff, what they don't realize is right now sexual exploitation is at a record high. There is so much more of this going on right now. But one of the things that you talk about in the book is, healing sexual trauma. Share a little bit about that process that may be helpful for somebody out there who knows someone who is going through it right now.
Oh, it's such an important topic. And again, it's so triggering and tough to talk about a lot of the time, but we need to. Yeah. For me, healing from sexual trauma is something that I also had to go through myself. And based on my experiences with my body and illness and all kinds of things that happened to me, I realized that I had to actually recognize that I had trauma. One of the most important things that we fail to realize about survivors of sexual assault and sexual trauma is that most of them underplay dramatically the trauma. Oh, well, it wasn't this bad. It could have been a lot worse. This didn't happen. That didn't happen. They internalize a lot of those attitudes about society blaming them, because victim blaming is still absolutely massive in rape culture. And we still are seeing the echoes of that rape culture throughout. So recognizing the trauma. So I detail my steps in the book. And the first step is actually admitting to yourself that this happened. And it doesn't have to just be sexual assault. It could be someone making fun of your genitals in the shower when you were a kid, and that traumatized you. Now you hate your body. It could be, you know, feeling like you have gender dysphoria, like you're born in the wrong body. And there's so many different ways that we're all kind of traumatized about sex. And it's because we have not had healthy channels for communication, and we've been afraid, and we've been shamed, and we've been judged. And we have to be able to release that. The other thing that I think is really important when it comes to healing sexual trauma is recognizing your triggers and recognizing your safe spaces and your unsafe spaces, because trauma is, PTSD from trauma can pop up at any time, seemingly innocuously. There can be a trigger from one event that can create a flashback of that same trauma. So recognizing them and kind of working through them so that eventually that list will get smaller, that list of the triggers will get smaller because you're acknowledging them. And then, you know, this is a long process, but we have to be able to connect with our unconscious patterning. So it's not enough to just go through our conscious minds. We actually have to go deeper, because a lot of these get ingrained into our brains. And I talk about a lot of different methods for that in the book. There's so many ways of doing it. And then finally, too, you have to change the dialogue in your head. You didn't deserve what happened to you. You are not a failure. You are not a bad human being. We have this ability to beat the crap out of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we are our own worst critics. And it's so simple. And I know you've probably heard it before, but I swear, if you were to talk to your best friend or your loved ones the way you talk to yourself, would they even like you as a friend? Yeah. And it's a conscious choice of self-love and self-care to say, I am worth it. I am a good person. I am enough. I don't deserve this. It's just so easy to go back and start beating the crap out of ourselves. So I talk about some exercises in the book that I have done, that I do with the people that I work with and that I care about, that have helped me kind of break free of a lot of that negative self-talk and self-limiting beliefs about who I am and what I'm capable of and if I'm allowed to be happy. And we are all allowed to be happy.
Yes. Couldn't agree more. The book is Sex Positive. And for everybody out there, it's available at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, or wherever it is that you buy it. And it should come up on the screen right now.
Yep. And the best part about it is, for those of you who are a little extra like me, you get to wave around this book that says sex in really big, bright red, white letters. And that's always fun for, you know, when you're out in public during COVID, especially.
Yeah, and for you guys out there, that doesn't mean that you can go get the book and walk around with it and show it around and then ask questions like, are you sex positive? Can you get it?
Exactly.
It's not what it's there for.
No, it's not.
Now, for those that would like to get a hold of you, what is the best way they can do that?
Absolutely. Okay, well, I've made a little website for the book. It's just sexpositivebook.com. And then if you're curious about my other content in my shows and podcasts, my show is called Lucid Planet Radio. I've been doing it for years. It's on SoundCloud and it's on Apple, I think, and Speaker and Stitcher.
Speaker and Stitcher.
There you go. And you can go to my website for that, which is just thelucidplanet.com. And that has all of my blog posts. And I like to interview people that inspire me and that are, you know, changing the consciousness of the world and explore those types of ideas. That's what I do. And then also on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, just Dr. Kelly Neff, DrKellyNeff.
There you go. And if you're driving out there and you're not able to write that stuff down, when you go to the Answers for the Family site, we will have all of this stuff there for you. Kelly, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it very much. And just keep up the good work. Keep making a positive difference in the world.
Thank you. Same to you. You know, love, gratitude, and good vibes, and we'll get through this together.
You got it. And to you. And for everybody else out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we will discuss the science of wearing masks. You will want to listen to this because there will be some pieces of information that you may not have heard about. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. And if you listen through iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spreaker, or SoundCloud, and you would like to see our guests, you can watch our shows on YouTube or Facebook. And if you like what you hear, please leave a comment or review. It will help us reach more people. And I want you to know we greatly appreciate it. So for everybody out there, be safe, be kind, be good humans, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.